Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Judge Jessen, Judge Klepacki, the Honorable Diane B. Bradfield presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is December 13th, 2022. The panel today has got six cases on its calendar. Four of those cases are oral, and I see today that the lawyers for the first case are present and in the courtroom. Before we go forward, I just want to say some things that I think everyone is aware of, but I just want to, you know, make our record clear. There is a recording that is maintained by the Court of Appeals, and I think it's important to note that today we do have a full panel here. Judge Klepacki is participating in this oral argument remotely, and I think everyone understands that we have the great benefit of technology, so that Judge Klepacki did not have to get on the roads today and travel because weather conditions are very potentially quite dangerous. And so we're using a meeting owl, which is placed on the podium near the microphone that will allow Judge Klepacki to hear everything. He's also able to have a visual of the courtroom, so I just want to make sure that the lawyers are aware of that as well. And he is able to participate in the argument by asking questions the same way as Judge Jessen and I at the bench. And so everyone knows that and is aware of it. If there are any questions, and of course this goes to Judge Klepacki too, who I'm lucky enough to be able to see on a laptop screen, but I know that the lawyers don't have a visual of Judge Klepacki. So if there are any questions from anyone during the course of the proceeding, in order to make this all work smoothly, just raise them and we'll deal with them as they come. Having said all of that, I'd like the marshal to call the first case.
Yes, Your Honor. Now calling case number A22-0829, Nicholas W. Sterry, appellant versus Minnesota Department of Corrections, respondent and correctional officer Ashley Youngberg in her individual and official capacities defendant.
Right, and as I said, I see the lawyers are here. For the first case, I'll make just a few quick remarks. First of all, we look very much forward to having the conversation today with both of you about this case. We have read and reviewed the briefs and appreciate the submissions. We know that you're aware of our procedures and know the time limits. It is, although we have a set of alternatives up there for you to speak to us, we prefer that you stand in the center podium, and that will allow for a lot of things to go more smoothly, specifically the recording.
Recording in progress.
We got a message. Our recording is in progress. So if you stand at the center of the podium, you'll be able, in the center podium, you'll be able to see your time, you know, working down, as well as the microphone will pick you up better for the sound system. So when you begin your remarks, please identify yourself as well as the client you represent and keep an eye on the clock. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Zoris Love-Lederman. I represent Mr. Sterry. Mr. Sterry was a plaintiff in the district court action. He is the appellant here. We are appealing a district court's dismissal of Mr. Sterry's claims against the Department of Corrections. The issue, Your Honors, before this court is whether the Department of Corrections gets absolute immunity for incidents involving on-duty sexual abuse by Department of Corrections officers against Department of Corrections inmates. The Department of Corrections position in this case is that the answer is straightforward, yes. So no matter what the facts are or where the relationship is, that if there is an incident of sexual abuse, the Department of Corrections is off the hook under the Tort Claims Act. Our position, Your Honor, is that the answer is that it depends. It depends on the facts. It depends on the specific duties of the officer involved. It also depends on the circumstances in which the sexual abuse or sexual contact occurred. So we're not.
I noticed that in your briefs, you made some reference to the fact that you're at some disadvantage in a Rule 12 because the facts aren't developed that they might be if it were a summary judgment or some other proceeding. But we have historically decided immunity issues under Rule 12, have we not?
Yes, Your Honor. This court has
And I look at your discussion of the facts,
Your Honor, from the plaintiff's or the appellant's perspective, we have submitted all the relevant facts. So the district court had those facts at its disposal, and this court does as well. I don't believe the district court really considered the facts as much as the law. I think the district court looked at this case more from a legal basis. And the question was, is it possible for the DOC to be liable in this case, or is it not, no matter what the facts are?
So, what are the limits that you would place on the concept of scope of employment?
Your Honor, I think the court should look at a number of factors. And so, first of all, we need to look at the specific context where the incident occurred. Is this a situation where the incident simply happened because we had a DOC inmate and DOC officer, they happened to be in the same place at the same time, or was there more to it? Number two, I think specifically in the civil context, was there consent? Because in a criminal case, we know based on the statute that consent is irrelevant because there can be consent in this sort of circumstance, but in the civil case, consent is a factor. So this is another factor the court should look at. The third factor that I think the court should consider is what exactly was happening between the officer and the inmate at the time of the sexual abuse. Were they simply walking past each other? Was this some kind of a routine cell check, or was there more to it? And here we have a situation where Officer Youngberg was actually supervising Mr. Sterry in his employment duties. He was employed in the kitchen. She was there to supervise him. She specifically directed him to enter a certain room for the purpose of doing some kind of inventory, and then without any kind of a warning, she made sexual contact with him. And so in our view, all of these factors make a difference. So you look at what was happening in the situation, and you the district court should have considered whether it's possible that these were acts that were committed within the scope of employment, because the
So, Mr. Lederman, and that is one of the things I'm struggling with, perhaps you could help me, is like when we're looking at the performance of duties or tasks, right? Should we be looking at when she assigned him to do the inventory check in the storage room? Was that within her scope of duties, or do we wait until it's like when she sexually harassed or assaulted him? It's pled in the complaint.
Right.
So what's the best case law that we have in Minnesota that would help us direct how broadly we look at scope of duties? Do we look at it 5 minutes before? Do we wait till that very, 30 seconds of when the act occurred?
Right, Your Honor. So unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot of case law to look at. To my knowledge, this particular situation hasn't come up in any appellate case law in Minnesota. We have the Doe 175 case, which is a little bit different. I'll talk about that. But we don't have any case that addresses this sort of context that we have here. Our position is that in terms of deciding what is within the scope of employment, that we should be looking at a broader picture of what the officer was doing. Because if we limit scope of employment to the specific act, then there would never be liability in any case. If we look at cases involving excessive force, for example, or somebody who is improperly handcuffed, or somebody who is placed into, somebody who is improperly strip searched. All of these things start within the scope of employment, but then they somehow progress into a situation that isn't.
So you're saying what's in the scope of employment really is a factual dispute, which is one of the reasons we should.
Right,
first.
So in this particular case, scope of employment is, was Officer Youngberg performing her employment duties when she, came into contact with Mr. Sterry and then eventually ordered him into this room where she sexually assaulted him? And the answer is that she was. She was doing her job. She was out.
The officer does have the authority to direct the movement of the prisoner, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the officer also have authority to search the prisoner at any time without any cause?
Per Department of Corrections policies, and this is some that wasn't developed fully given the Rule 12 posture, but yes, Department of Corrections employees do have the ability to conduct searches of inmates for weapons.
And can an inmate be disciplined for not complying with directions as to where to go, what to do while in the institution?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Mr. Sterry was subject to discipline for failing to follow Officer Youngberg's directives, and this is one of the...
Do all of these items factor into the question of scope of employment?
Yes. As we talk about in our briefing, Your Honor, all of these factors are definitely relevant because Mr. Sterry had no choice. He cannot disregard Officer Youngberg. He can, yes, he can decide not to follow her directives, and then he can be subject to discipline for that. And that's one of the main elements that distinguishes this case from this Doe 175 case. Again, I don't want to minimize what happened in that case. That was a young high school student who was being victimized by a coach. But we didn't have the sort of in-custody environment as we do here, where Mr. Sterry has to do what he is told by the officers of the facility. He's subject to discipline for refusing the directives. And yes, that this could have been potentially a search of his person, because the way that the situation unfolded, she ordered him into a room, and then without any sort of prior warning or directive, she started touching him. So he could have viewed this as a search pursuant to Department of Corrections policies. I want to talk for a minute with regards to other cases that we do have that don't involve the government. So we do have a body of case law dealing with sexual assault incidents that occur in other settings. A lot of them happen in a kind of a therapeutic environment where somebody is receiving therapy. Again, it's not an in-custody setting, it's not a government employer, but we do have a set of legal standards that apply to those cases. Our position is that the same standard should apply to the Department of Corrections case as well. And so the focus there is on foreseeability, and the focus there is whether the plaintiff is able to provide expert testimony establishing that this sort of conduct is foreseeable in this particular context, despite all the training and all of the procedural guidelines that are in place for Department of Corrections employees.
So, counsel, I'd like to... Judge Klopacki, you and I were speaking over each other. Would you like to go ahead? Okay. So here's my question for you, counsel, on looking at the other case law. And I think one of the cases you're mentioning is the Fahrendorf case.
Yes. Right?
So Fahrendorf was decided, actually, it's true of Doe 175. They're both summary judgment decisions. Right. They're not Rule 12. Judge Klopacki is certainly correct that we do have lots of immunity cases that are decided under a Rule 12 context. But this is, the Fahrendorf case was decided on summary judgment, and I think there was expert testimony submitted in support of the plaintiff's claim in that case. Now, of course, you're not at that point yet in this case of submitting evidence. Were there allegations included in the complaint that dealt with foreseeability, this issue you're raising now, that was explored in Fahrendorf?
Your Honor, there were issues regarding foreseeability due to Officer Youngberg's other incidents of abuse of other inmates. I will know for the record that, as we pointed out in our briefing, sexual abuse of inmates by correctional officers is a known issue. It's a known issue despite training that's provided and despite everything else that happens when employees come and work for the Department of Corrections. Now, specifically with regards to the Minnesota Department of Corrections, there are reviews that are conducted annually. This is public information. The DOC publishes it. These things happen every year despite the training that's provided. And so the DOC knows that these things happen. The DOC knows that from time to time, inmates will be sexually abused by officers, and that the Department of Corrections can put all of the time and resources into making sure these things don't occur and providing proper training and providing proper procedures that are in place for reporting these incidents, but they do nonetheless happen. And so...
Is this part of your complaint? So that the judge had this information, this factual scenario for Rule 12?
It was not part of our complaint, Your Honor, but we were also not at the point where that information is typically submitted. So this is all summary judgment information, especially expert evidence. I have handled other similar cases that were able to progress the summary judgment, and I have provided this sort of evidence in those cases. We just simply did not reach that point here because This was a Rule 12 motion, and the district court decided that it doesn't matter what the facts are or whether or not the facts were foreseeable, that as a matter of law, the Department of Corrections cannot be held vicariously liable in this case. One final note that I want to make here. I think the court should also look at and consider whether, if we look at the facts of what happened between Officer Youngberg and Mr. Sterry, if we were to set aside this issue of sexual contact, was there anything else that occurred that was outside the scope of her duties? And the answer is that there wasn't. She was there doing her work. He was there doing his work. This was a routine situation where she was supervising him. The only element that kind of throws this case out of her employment duties is the fact that she touched him inappropriately. But the fact that everything else that occurred between them was normal DOC procedure, I think supports our position, is that overall her conduct in this case was within the scope of her employment, especially considering that we're under Rule 12 instead of Rule 56 on summary judgment. Final note, Your Honors, is I think we should consider the general purpose of the Tort Claims Act. We have obviously sovereign immunity, which is waived. And what the DOC advocates for in this case is that sovereign immunity should be waived for your typical run-of-the-mill abuses that happen within the DOC. But when it comes to the most egregious violations that could happen within that setting, that sovereign immunity should apply. And to us, that doesn't make any sense. That's all I have, Your Honors. Thank you.
Are there any other questions from the panel? And, of course, counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you.
So, Marshall, I'm going to ask you if you're able. There's a sort of a message that's blocking my view of Judge Klopaki. Yeah, and I have a feeling we can dismiss that message. All right, thank you. Counsel for respondent, we're ready for you. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the Court. Anna Veit Carter on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. There is no dispute that the allegations underlying this action are disturbing, but the issue before the Court here today is one of statutory construction, whether the DOC is immune from vicarious liability claims based on alleged sexual abuse by an officer against an inmate under the plain language of the Minnesota Tort Claims Act. Here, the district court correctly concluded that the Tort Claims Act effectively severs the DOC's liability based on the definition of the scope of employment provided by the act. Because she was acting outside of the scope of employment when she allegedly assaulted appellant, the DOC is immune. Accordingly, the DOC asks that this court affirm the district court's order.
So is it your view that the common law concepts of time, place are irrelevant?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. The foreseeability issues that come into play through Fahrendorf and the common law do not apply here. The statute provides a limited waiver of the sovereign immunity for the state and its agencies, and therefore it must be strictly construed, and the court needs to look to the definition provided in the statute.
Which do you think that the fact that we're dealing with a custodial situation here where not only is custodial, but where the officer has the ability to take action against the inmate for not complying with the officer's directions. You don't think that has any bearing on what is within the scope under the Tort Claims Act?
No, and for a few reasons. First of all, I respectfully disagree that provides a substantive distinction from the Doe 175 case. There you had a person of authority, a coach and weight room supervisor, who had groomed a young woman, a juvenile, and the contention that she had a meaningful opportunity to leave an office where she was alone with him, I think is unavailing. And second of all, again, the court is bound by the statute. And there's no language.
In terms of the custody here, it's not just whether someone can leave, but whether someone is subject to some retaliatory action. officer is demanding, because that's part of the prison environment.
But the definition provided by the statute is focused on the scope of employment of the employee at issue. It doesn't address the circumstances that the victim finds themselves in.
So is foreseeability part of scope of employment?
Not for the state as an employer. For a private employer, yes. For the state, no.
So if I could come back to that. So your statutory interpretation argument, the net result of that would be that all sexual harassment and sexual assault claims against the state based upon vicarious liability would be barred by immunity.
Correct.
That, not just corrections, that would be just across the board, assuming that at some point that employee got a sexual harassment or sexual assault policy, which we know employees in the executive branch get, right?
Correct. They do get that. I don't know that that has a bearing when you look at the definition.
Okay,
I guess,
so they didn't even have to get that. Your position, your statutory position, they would just all be barred by immunity. The sexual harassment and sexual assault claims against the state based on vicarious liability.
That could never be within the scope of employment. An employee is never going to be directed and cannot lawfully be directed to sexually harass or sexually assault someone.
I just want to make sure that we understand the implications of the state's argument here. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
What if there's a history on an employee's part of engaging in that kind of conduct so that foreseeability is very high and, in fact, the governmental agency does nothing about it? Is that within the tenor of the idea of the immunity that the statute grants?
Here, appellant also asserted a negligent supervision claim, and that issue may come into to context on a negligent supervision claim where it's about whether or not the employer knew that they had previously engaged in conduct. That whether or not the employee previously engaged in that conduct doesn't come into context with the claims that are appealed here, which is negligence, I believe it's assault, intentional negligent infliction of emotional distress. So I do not believe that that should be part of the court's analysis here. I respectfully disagree that this reading prohibits any potential intentional tort. Appellant's counsel provided a broad scope of what he believes this reading is, but there could hypothetically be a situation where an officer is directed to use force to address a fight or another situation in a prison and could be sued for battery or assault under those circumstances where this would not prohibit recovery against the state. But again, I think it's important that the...
And counsel, explain how we get there. You know, so let's go with that hypothetical. Say that, and you can tell it to me if you'd like. Is this something, a fight initiated between two inmates and an officer responds to try to restore some kind of peaceful behavior and in the course of that hurts one of the inmates? And then you're saying, oh, yeah, definitely the officer would potentially be liable as well as the DOC?
I think, yes, potentially. Obviously, it is fact-dependent in that circumstance. But if they are
right, we're only talking about Rule 12 here. We're not going all the way down to the end. So we are just talking about whether that would state a claim.
Yes.
So you say it would?
Yes,
okay.
It would potentially.
So I'm just surprised you said that, because in light of your analysis, it seems to me that it is never within an officer, the scope of an officer's duties to harm an employee, in that effort to restore peace, say, with an inmate fight. So, I mean, how would that
At a Rule 12 stage, I think that could potentially state a claim to survive a motion to dismiss. You know, whether at the summary judgment stage that is determined to be within the scope of employment, depending on the officer's actions, I think becomes more of a fact question. But at a Rule 12 stage, I think that would be enough to get passed.
So let's change the scenario a bit between Officer Youngberg and Mr. Sterry. So say Officer Youngberg, I think, does have the authority to search inmates, and including Mr. Sterry, right?
Under certain circumstances, yes.
Okay, and so you can help me out with what the circumstances are. So if Officer Youngberg is able to search Sterry within the scope of her employment, and in fact has the duty to do so under certain situations, starts that search, it's a body search. It includes his private parts, and it includes inappropriate touching and groping of those private parts. So is that a case? You know, if that were what was alleged here, that where it would state a claim and would go beyond the sovereign immunity you've described?
If it is under those circumstances, I think that could potentially survive a motion to dismiss. That would become a fact question of whether or not she went beyond the scope of her duties in conducting the search, which would need further development. Here, such development is not needed because based on the facts alleged in the complaint, it's clear that the plaintiff clearly alleges that she sexually assaulted him, which cannot be within the scope of her duties. So that doesn't preclude a Rule 12 dismissal on this matter.
So if the claim had been for assault, not sexual assault, that would be different? Is that what you're saying, counsel?
I don't think so. I mean, I think here there wasn't a specific assault claim, but the basis of the allegations were that she inappropriately fondled him, and not as part of a search. It is the DOC's position that Doe controls, because there, the coach was working on school grounds in a scope as a weight room supervisor when the sexual assault occurred. And this court noted that the limitations of vicarious liability to acts done within the scope of the employment expressly excludes the vicarious liability for actions outside the scope of employment. And because the defendant engaged in sexual misconduct for his own reasons, not on behalf of the school, the school could not be held liable. Here, Officer Youngberg, if she was sexually assaulting the plaintiff or the appellant, that was for her own personal reasons. The attempts to distinguish...
So, counsel, this analysis of personal reasons, and you're absolutely correct, that is included in the Doe 175 case. It's also discussed by the Supreme Court in the Fahrendorf case. And so, sitting here today, I'm a bit confused as to how to apply those two very different views of personal reasons for the assault, because there were assaults in both of those cases. So would you help me out in that, or do you see an area of uncertainty in the law that perhaps warrants clarification?
I do not, Your Honor. And that is...
Personal reasons aren't relevant if it's the government, and they are relevant if it's a private employer. I mean, that's...
There is a significant distinction here when there is a private employer and the state employer, and that's because the sovereign immunity at issue and the limited waiver of the State Tort Claims Act.
But that the doesn't Supreme say Court, that in the language of the State Tort Claims Act. So that's where I'm asking. I would love to have you bring me back to your statutory construction, because that's what I am struggling with exactly, is where do we eliminate this, these personal reasons based on the language of the Tort Claims Act?
So one additional point on Fahrendorf. The Supreme Court did not consider the statute at all, did not...
Right, it's not a government employee, or employer, right.
And
absolutely.
So it's the Doe opinion that we believe controls, which is where the personal reasons comes in their conclusion. And the Tort Claims Act definition of scope of employment is acting on behalf of the state, not acting on behalf of themselves, acting on behalf of the state in the performance of duties or tasks lawfully assigned by competent authority. And I think that provides the clarification that it has to be...
So getting back to Judge Jessen's question, and I apologize for interrupting you, but I just want to make sure I get a chance to ask you this. So you talked about when the employee here, Officer Youngberg, was acting on behalf of the state. So what point in time do we look at? You know, when Officer Youngberg directs Mr. Sterry to go into the supply room and begin the inventory, or do we wait until she touches him?
I think you wait until she touches him, because it is the action, it is the actual assault that must be considered by the court, and whether that action that the claims are based on was within the performance of duties.
I guess the last question I would have for you, and I want to make sure the other panel members get a chance to follow up, is if that's true, aren't we really in a situation where there are conflicting inferences that can be drawn in light of the fact that scope of employment generally is a question of fact? I definitely hear and understand the inferences you are drawing based on the timeline and the set of acts that you've described, but obviously the appellant has argued exactly the opposite. And there are conflicting inferences that could be drawn from the facts.
I think I respectfully disagree that there can be conflicting inferences about whether or not assaulting someone sexually would be within the scope of employment.
It's a, again, you're misunderstanding my question. It's not about whether the assault is within the scope. It's at what point in time do we examine the employee here, Officer Youngberg, her duties, and whether she was acting on behalf of the state. She certainly was, you know, in the time and place of her employment. She was within the time and place of her duty, assigned duties, which was to supervise the employees in the kitchen and even apparently to order individual inmates into supply rooms and conduct inventory from based on the allegations in the complaint. None of this has been proven.
Correct.
Right. So that's my question is, does that set up a series of facts undisputed at this point, because we're dealing with allegations in the complaint, from which conflicting inferences can be drawn about the scope of employment?
I don't think so. I think as the district court drew the line and found that the assault itself, mm-hmm. based on the allegations in the complaint, that was sufficient enough to apply the immunity here. And the court previously noted that DOE 175 was a summary judgment motion. I don't think that procedural posture is relevant given the broad nature of the rule there. Again, there he was acting within the scope of his employment by acting as a weight room supervisor when he assaulted the plaintiff there. But yet, once the assault occurred, he was acting outside of the scope of employment. And we ask that this court reject appellant's request to overturn DOE 175 or create this distinction based on the custodial context that does not have support within the statutory language.
But it just seems to me there's a lot more, and maybe this just the problem is it does get, from your perspective, it gets back to time and place, but there's a lot more room between the coach in DOE and the girl, that is it 14-year-old?
14-year-old, there. Correct.
I mean, she wasn't on his team. She came to events. A lot more time and space between them, although that was awful what happened, than here. Which, you know, yes, it's custodial, but it's like she orders him in the supply room and then this assault happens. You know, that just seems to be very factually distinguishable from the Doe case.
I disagree. The plaintiff was a student athlete who visited the weight room as a student athlete. The coach was the supervisor of the weight room. So I think the distance between the two is much, much smaller than appellant would have you believe. So given that, there's no, it's still a gross abuse of power against a vulnerable person. So unless the court has any additional questions for me, we'd ask that that you affirm the district court's order.
I'm not seeing any questions from the panel. Okay, very good. Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, with regards to the comment about overturning the Doe 175 case, I don't believe it's necessary for the court to overturn or to question the findings in that case. A couple of reasons. First of all, we're here on Rule 12. That was a summary judgment decision. And second of all, as the court has mentioned, the facts of that case are just distinguishable on numerous fronts from what's happening here. We have a custodial environment. We have a person who is in prison custody subject to discipline versus kind of a more laid-back relationship between the coach and the student in that case. So this court can issue a decision in this case permitting these claims to potentially go forward without calling into question or overturning anything that happened in the Doe case. Second point I want to make is to address the comments about this issue of personal reasons, whether the fact that Officer Youngberg acted for personal reasons should somehow impact whether vicarious liability should apply. There can be situations where an officer conducts a strip search, which is lawful and proper per procedure, and at the same time, somehow that officer enjoys some kind of personal gratification from that strip search. I don't think we should be looking at whether or not there was some kind of personal reason behind what happened or there wasn't, because first of all, whether it's personal or not is not in the statutes. that is not a factor that the statute considers.
Well, counsel, I think the argument that at least I'm hearing respondent make is that, well, it is actually in the statute because the statute defines scope of employment as including the employee acting on behalf of the state.
Right.
And I may not have that exactly, but it's roughly that.
Yes.
So I think there is a statutory hook there, and if you'd address it, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. And that was going to be kind of my last point I wanted to make. I want to go back to the arguments I made previously that we have to look at a broader picture. We can't just isolate the specific act and set aside everything else. We have to look at the entire context, decide what was the relationship between the employee of the state and the person injured. And was the employee of the state generally engaged in performance of her duties? And again, as I mentioned earlier, in this case, the answers are yes, she was doing everything that she was supposed to, except for the one of inappropriate touching. And we can't isolate one specific act from the entire picture.
Well, does the inappropriate touching even, does it assist her as exercising control over this inmate?
Your Honor, I'm not sure whether it assists her. She could have had other reasons for touching him. She could have done it for safety. She could have done it as part of a search.
That's my point.
Right.
Whatever she was doing, inferences can be drawn as to why she was doing it, and some of those inferences might even keep it within the scope of employment, would it not? She's going to have continuing supervision over this person. No question about it.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor, and some of the cases that we cite in our brief from other jurisdictions do focus on that issue. They focus on the fact that even though this sort of conduct is prohibited, that everyone knows that they should not be doing this, the fact that the employee engaged in conduct that's prohibited doesn't automatically bar vicarious liability. And those courts have looked at the specific incident in question, what was happening, and the cases don't suggest that the vicarious liability will apply in every circumstance, but that case law that we cite does suggest that there are circumstances where vicarious liability will apply and where it will not. And we simply never got to that point in this case due to the district court adopting the state's arguments that it doesn't matter what the context is or what happened, the statute simply prohibits vicarious liability. And we ask this court to reconsider that decision.
Any other questions from the panel? All right, very good. Thank you, counsel.
Thanks
to both counsel in this case. This matter was very well argued and well briefed. We appreciate your submissions to the court. It is now taken by the court and submitted to the court for a decision. We will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.